If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Wearing a Men's Warehouse outfit makes you confident, like you could do anything, so you dance like no one is watching, even though everyone is watching. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you interview like the job is already yours because it is. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you golf as if the rules don't apply to you because you're too well-dressed for rules. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit. At Men's Warehouse, get measured, get fitted, get hot, get confident in everything from tailored suits to underwear and all the stuff in between. Love the way you look at Men's Warehouse.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's interview is with Orlando Figes, who's Professor of History at Birkbeck and also the author of numerous best-selling books on European and in particular Russian history. His latest book, which has just been published, is The Europeans, which explores the great cultural changes of the 19th century through three remarkable people: the singer Pauline Viardot, her husband, the author and connoisseur Louis, and the third member of their love triangle, the acclaimed Russian author Ivan Turgenev. Our editor, Rob Attar, met up with Orlando at his office in Birkbeck to find out more.
Why did you choose this particular trio to illustrate the wider theme of your book?
Well, they sort of chose me, really. I mean, I had come to this, it's so long ago that I started on the book, I can barely remember, through Turgenev's letters. He's a wonderful letter writer, and that drew me to Pauline Viardot, the great opera singer, composer, hostess of salons, great mover and shaker of cultural life in 19th century Europe. And their relationship is obviously very intriguing. He fell madly in love with her when she came to Petersburg in 1843, and he followed her and her husband, Louis Viardot, a great art expert connoisseur around Europe. And that got me into their story, and I began to research the archives in that. And then I began to think about this trio as not just artists and cultural practitioners, but as entrepreneurs in an art world that was obviously functioning within a sort of market system. I got interested in Turgenev's economy, in Pauline Viardot's economy, in the whole management of opera issues. And so that sort of led me to the big theme of the book. And I just thought this trio served as a very good armature, if you like, to explore how Europe was brought together, I think, it's my argument, through its artworks, its literature, its music, in a new commercial environment. In other words, it was the market forces of the 19th century, the new technologies, the legal infrastructure of copyright that enabled artists to make a living out of the arts, but also enable publishers and disseminators and impresarios to internationalize the arts in a way that I think really brought Europe together, so that by the end of the 19th century, everyone's effectively reading the same books, going to the same theatre and opera and listening to the same music, or playing it at home in sheet music and buying the same reproductions of the great artworks. So that when we think of Europe today as defined by its sort of high culture, if you like, that is a product of the 19th century.
People often don't like to think of art in purely commercial terms, but is it your argument then that actually the financial and commercial changes were crucial to the cultural developments taking place?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, it was only with the new technologies of the 19th century, with the railways, with the telegraph, with copyright developments enabling people to make money out of the reproduction of art, that the market for the art could be internationalized. I mean, before all of those developments, roughly up until the 1830s, I suppose, there was a market in the arts, but it was localized. It would be around a court or a group of connoisseurs or an academy or a society for music. It was only when lithography enabled sheet music to be cheaply produced, when the railways enabled the distribution of books and artworks to become economical on a mass base, that you find these spheres of art becoming not quite globalized, I guess, but certainly internationalized, so that an opera being premiered in Milan could then become known very quickly throughout Europe, not by necessarily its performance, but by the publication of its most popular arias. So that was all driven, I think, by the technologies of the 19th century and by the economies, in the sense that it was economical for publishers, theatre managers to go for what was familiar and popular. And what was familiar and popular was what was easily accessed through the print media. So there's a sort of virtuous circle that is being formed between mass reproduction of artworks, whether that's through pocket editions of popular literature or cheap engravings or sheet music, and the interest of the public in the live performance. So it's a bit, if you like today, I guess, you hear something on Spotify and then Spotify tells you where you can hear the live music. So that sort of cycle was being created and economically becoming a very powerful force because of the ability of impresarios, publishers, and above all, the artists themselves to make money out of the reproduction of their work. So, you know, the money in opera or the money in art wasn't in the sale of the original, the score or the production or the original artwork. It was in the mass reproduction.
And we're talking here about forms of culture today that I guess are often called high culture. But actually, at the time, would this be the equivalent of what we call like pop music now? Was this percolating down to the masses rather than just the elite?
Absolutely. I mean, we think of opera now as a sort of rarefied elite art form. But in the 19th century, it was very popular. And in Italy in particular, there were several hundred opera houses. It was a genuinely popular art form. And if a new, say, Verdi opera came out, within days of the premiere, there were organ grinders playing the music. You could hear it being played by bands on a bandstand. It was being sung by cafe performers. It was that quick, the dissemination of opera, right down to, the cafe concert, the tavern, the music hall, and so on. So the way we think today of this sort of great bifurcation between high culture and mass culture didn't really exist at that time, in the sense that they were both then feeding off each other. It was really only with the conscious creation of a canon of classical music. The idea of classical music was an invention of the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. It's only at that point that this divide begins to develop. But even after that, high culture remains popular.
And when we're talking about Europe at this point, Does that embrace all of what we now think of as Europe, or was it only really certain countries that were involved in the cultural transmission?
Well, I'm glad you asked it, because in a way, you know, you asked about the Tagaina Viardot circle. And one of the other great things for me in picking those three was that Louis Viardot was a Frenchman. Pauline Viardot was born in France, but of Spanish descent. And Turgenev is a Russian. And at that time, at the beginning of the 19th century, I guess you could say that Russia and Spain were peripheral to what we think of as the sort of center of Europe at that time, which is Paris. And yet what happens in the 19th century through the development of translation, through the internationalization of all the arts, is that, and above all, perhaps through international travel, is that the peripheral countries join the mainstream. And the Tagaina Viardot circle played a very important part in this. So I think probably Pauline was more responsible than anybody for bringing Spanish music into the mainstream of the European repertoire. So if we think of all those French composers of the 1870s, Saint-Saëns, Fire, and all the rest of them, bringing in Spanish music to their French classical music, as we call it now, that was largely due, actually, to Pauline. Likewise, Turgenev played a crucial role in bringing Russian literature into the European mainstream. So it was Turgenev who first really brought to the attention of the Western European public Tolstoy's War and Peace. And not only did he bring Tolstoy into the European mainstream of, say, dominated by France, but he took Flaubert to Russia. He got Flaubert and Zola translated in Russia. In fact, Zola's works were published in Russia before they were published in France, many of them. So this trio played a very important part in bringing the periphery into the mainstream. And as a result of these developments, I think you could say that, coming back to your original question, that the concept of what Europe was is widening, broadening. That by 1900, certainly by the time Diaghilev comes to Paris with his Saison Russe, St. Petersburg is very much part of European civilization in a way that it hadn't been seen when the book begins in the 1830s and 40s.
Russia has always had this slightly unusual position, hasn't it, between Europe and Asia? And was that dilemma still going on in the 19th century about which way the country should pivot?
Certainly for the Russian intelligentsia, there were divides on that score between, most famously in the polemics, or between the Westernists and the Slavophiles. Tagaina was a great Westernist, and his position was that Russia needed to develop its culture on the basis of its own character, but only once it had achieved the sort of level of civilization by imbibing everything from Europe. So he was very critical of all those Slavophile nationalist composers who he thought were essentially amateurs. So he was quite critical, to begin with, of Mussorgsky and others who were essentially self-taught, and he felt not professional enough. They, in other words, needed to learn from the German masters before building their own national character. But he did later come to see that they had something original to bring. It's just that he believed that originality had to be universal, had to be part of a universal European tradition. And I think that's essentially what Europe meant for Westernists in Russia, but also for all Europeans in the 19th century, that European culture was essentially a universal culture. That's partly an Enlightenment idea, and today I guess it would be criticized for being neo-imperialist or whatever, in the sense that they thought it was good for the rest of the world. And there is that weakness in it, but it was also an integrating force for the periphery, and a liberating force for many subjugated by foreign cultures. So if you think of Southeastern Europe or the lands under Austro-Hungarian rule, where German culture was dominant, being able to access a broader European cosmopolitanism was a liberating force.
This era is also known for the rise, certainly by the late 19th century, of nationalism and nationalist forces. How does that play off against this idea of a broadening European culture?
Very good question. And I think the book is framed by two trajectories, two waves of, on the one hand, cultural cosmopolitanism with the opening of borders, the translation of cultures and the melting pot created, which we call European culture as a result. And on the other hand, a more exclusive form of nationalism, which I think really only gains force in the last decades of the 19th century. Even, say, German nationalism in the early 19th century is a cosmopolitan force. It's a German identity built on European values and open to the influence of France, Bohemia, so that Weber's Der Freischütz, for example, which is often called the first German national opera, it's in fact largely French and Bohemian in its influence. So that is a cosmopolitan or international sense of the nation, yeah, where the nation and the European aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. By the end of the 19th century, yes, there's a sort of reaction against this cultural cosmopolitanism. You see it in particular, for example, in France, where there was, as a result of, I think, largely the result of international copyright, a very vibrant translation culture, so that the French book market was flooded by foreign translations from the 1880s. In particular, Russian translations, for translations from the Russian, very popular in France, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and so on. But also the Scandinavians were coming. And a lot of French nationalists, conservatives, many of those who would back the sort of anti-Dreyfus movement, saw this as a sort of weakening of the French national character. So there was a sort of nationalist backlash to the cosmopolitanism. And those two trajectories, I mean, they overlap. They're not always mutually exclusive. They are increasingly in a state of friction with each other, I think. And in a sense, the story comes to an end with 1914, when political nationalism bursts onto the scene and destroys this, as Stefan Zweig would call it, illusion of Europe. But it does so, the eve of 1914 was the high point of European cosmopolitanism. It was the high point of the international transfers crisscrossing across Europe in all of the arts. So even at the end of my story, 1914, it's still, two trajectories that are not necessarily exclusive. And that's one of the elements I wanted to redress to the historiography in the sense that I think the cultural history of 19th century Europe has always been told really about the development of nationalism, national identity, cultural nationalism. So it's been handled in terms of the nation state, German culture, French culture. And actually the biggest story, which is often forgotten, is about the development of European culture, the internationalism of the arts, and the sort of global culture that we have today was already being brought into existence by the end of the period I'm covering.
Three people that your book centres around lived in quite an unusual ménage à trois situation. How did that work? Because, even nowadays that sounds like quite a difficult situation to navigate. Were all three people happy with that arrangement?
It is very difficult to tell how exactly it worked and how happy it was for all three concerned, partly because so much of the evidence has been destroyed. Turgenev did keep diaries, but destroyed them. Pauline Viardot and Turgenev obviously had a bigger correspondence than the letters that have survived would suggest. And she clearly destroyed some before her death. But I've tried my best to give my interpretation of it on the sources and not to make too many speculations. I think that until the 1860s, when they all retired together, in a sense, to live in Baden-Baden and lived for the first time together, in the sense that they... Turgenev didn't live in the same house. The villa of the Viardos was about 50 metres away from the little pavilion he built on land he bought adjoining theirs. From that point onwards, they are living effectively in an open ménage à trois. But they were doing so in Baden, which was sort of summer capital of Europe, a holiday city because the aristocracy, crowned heads of state, went to Baden for pleasure. So, you know, there were many high-placed people who kept a mistress there, and it was not a place where people took a sort of sanctimonious view. It was a place where people went for pleasure. And that, I think, gave this trio greater freedom to live in a way that people didn't frown upon. Before that, in France, in particular, in Paris, it was more difficult. So the Viardot household had its salon, and anybody who was anybody in 19th century Europe spent some time at the Viardot salon. All the great figures of Paris in the 19th century were habitués of the salon for its music and its conversation. And Turgenev was always there. And although it was known that he was in a romantic relationship with Pauline, because he was always there as a guest, it enabled the sort of appearance of just friendship to be maintained. There were moments when there was gossip, and there is the odd letter from Louis Viardot to Pauline saying, look, I don't really mind what you do, but just don't give grounds for gossip. The relationship between Louis and Turgenev was very good. They were very close friends. They worked together on some publications in translation, and they were great hunting companions. They both loved hunting. Louis was considerably older than Pauline, so perhaps he just had a benign, slightly complacent view about Pauline's admirers, and there were many admirers. So Turgenev wasn't the first. Berlioz, Gounod, Maurice Sand all fell in love with Pauline. But Turgenev was the great love of her life. And I think, although there were periods when they didn't quite fall apart, but where Turgenev had to keep his distance, particularly in the late 1850s when she gave birth to her son Paul, which was probably Turgenev's son. And he kept his distance at that point to avoid any gossip that might ruin his career. So there were difficult moments, but once they left Paris and settled in Baden, and then even more so when they came back to Paris after a brief stay here in London in the 1870s, they effectively were ménage à trois, and it was known, and nobody really gossiped about it in the circles they moved in. But in the broader circles of society, it was used against Louis Viardot in particular, because Louis was a radical Republican, a socialist, I think. And he, in the 1870s, stood for election on several occasions in the Paris municipal elections. And at that point, he found this odd domestic situation being used against him, so that in election campaigns people would say that, you know, he was a sort of pimp for his wife, that his wife was a prostitute, all the sort of things you can imagine being said. But I don't think at that point they cared anymore, to be honest. I think they lived by their own ethical principles. The people they cared about knew what was going on, and they lived under the same roof.
What's your take from writing a book on Turgenev? Because he's a name who's maybe not as famous now as he once was, but at the time was a real giant of European literature.
That's right. Turgenev really was the first of the great Russian writers to be known in the West. He was translated into German, English, French from the 1840s and was widely read in the 1850s and 60s, particularly in Germany, where many German writers complained that Turgenev was the most popular writer in Germany. And I think part of his success was that he wrote in a very Europeanized Russian, which was well and easily translated, I think, in a way that couldn't be said of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, who eclipsed Turgenev later, as you say, because they were more exotically Russian, can I say. They were more what the Western audience expected of the Russian writer. So when Turgenev died in 1883, he quite quickly got forgotten. Until that point, he was the major Russian writer. And then very quickly after, although he had great admirers, particularly, for example, Henry James and Thomas Mann. By the 1910s, he was not forgotten, but he'd definitely been eclipsed by Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Why did I choose Turgenev? I love him as a figure. I think he's an absolutely adorable man whose view of the world I largely share, whose humane liberalism, Westernism is deeply sympathetic to me, whose views on art and life in general are deeply sympathetic. I love his great friend, soulmate really, Gustave Flaubert, who is very similar to Turgenev in terms of temperament and outlook. And I love his writing. And I particularly love, I mean, Fathers and Sons is his great novel, I suppose, a novel of ideas set in the 1860s, turmoil and the conflict between generations, which is very relevant to what's going on today in many ways. But I particularly love his book, and always have loved his book, Sketches from a Hunter's Album, which was this deeply humane portrait of rural society, of the serfs, the stupidity and follies of the nobility, which miraculously passed the censors in Russia and played a vital role in ending serfdom, for which Russia should always be deeply indebted to Turgenev. So he's a tremendously appealing character. And I think, as I said before, the one thing that really drew me to him and kept me with him is that I think perhaps his greatest work is his letters. Wonderful letter writer. And I've, you know, love quoting many of them, particularly his letters to Pauline, which are sensational.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Henry Mayhew wrote in his notes on Germany in the 1860s that the further one went south in Europe, it was like travelling back in time. So that by the time one got to Spain, it was like entering the Middle Ages. And that was a fairly common Victorian attitude.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Coming on to Pauline Viardot, I guess the challenge in her case is that, though she was a great singer, we don't have her recording. So is it hard to appreciate now how famous and how successful she was in her time, when we have nothing of her work remaining, or not of her vocal work?
It is, yes. I mean, she stopped singing. I mean, she sang in the 1870s, but her last sort of great performance was the premiere of Brahms's Alto Rhapsody in 1869. And phonogram obviously only came into existence in the 1890s. We have a crackly recording of one of Pauline's greatest pupils, Marianne Brandt, who was a sort of big Wagnerian singer and sang a similar repertoire to Pauline and was supposed to have a voice similar to hers. But we only have descriptions of her voice, which had an extraordinary range, which had a sort of almost guttural element to it that lent itself both to great operatic tragedy, but also Spanish gypsy songs. Saint-Saëns said her voice was like bitter oranges. So we can sort of imagine what it would sound like. But imagining what she meant in the 19th century is much more than saying she was, say, the equivalent of Maria Callas. I mean, that is not to compare like with like, in the sense that Pauline was not just a great singer, and people would travel from all over Europe to hear her give a premiere. So Dickens traveled from London to Paris for the express purpose of seeing Pauline in her greatest role as Orfeu in Berlioz's revival of Gluck's opera in 1859. It's that she was a creator of roles. I never really understood what a creator of roles meant in opera history. But with Pauline, it's clear what it meant. It meant that she advised the composers on the vocal lines and much more, and created the role because she worked with the composer. And she did that not just for Orfeu, but for Fides in Meyerbeer's opera Le Prophète, in Gounod's Sappho, in many other operas. And it's not just that she created the role, it's that she was a great influencer. You know, she published songs that she'd written. She transcribed Spanish songs to bring them into the European mainstream. She promoted Spanish composers. Later, with Turgenev's help, Russian composers. She held what was probably the most important salon in Paris for much of the mid-19th century, and then in Baden, and then in London. And so everybody in that world sort of knew her. And so it's not like she's just a musician, or that music, as it does now, is sort of a world of its own. It's that she was connected with artists, painters like Delacroix, Schaeffer, with writers, with people like Dickens, Victor Hugo, Turgenev, and Flaubert, and with, obviously, musicians in her own world. So we tend to think of the arts as, you know, literature, music, the visual arts. She was at the center of a cultural world where all of these worked together, and they all met in her salon. So to say, you know, what was Pauline Viardot, you can't really just say she was a singer, or even just a singer and a composer. She was a sort of cultural universe, or the center of a cultural universe.
And did she face any additional challenges by the fact that she was a woman in the 19th century?
Very good question. And I have written about that in one of the chapters. What was, I think, rather extraordinary about Pauline was that she was effectively her own business manager and toured on her own, toured around Europe on her own. And that was quite unusual for a woman at that time. In continental Europe, where the Napoleonic Code was basically in force, she didn't have the right to sign contracts on her own. So all her early contracts, which we have with Covent Garden or the Paris Opéra, they all have to be countersigned and approved by her husband. But Louis Viardot ceased to be her manager. She was when they married. But by the mid-1850s, he's no longer playing that role. And Pauline is touring Europe on her own, and she's signing her own contracts, negotiating her own salaries, and she's acting as stage manager when on tour quite often. And she's quite a mercenary. People see her as mercenary. I'm not sure she was mercenary. She had this saying that never sing for nothing. And indeed, at Chopin's funeral, Chopin was a close personal friend of hers, and she sang at his funeral at the Madeleine in Paris in 1849 and had the gall to collect 2,000 francs as a fee. Everyone else, as you might expect of Chopin's friends, gave their services for nothing. But I'm not sure how mercenary she really was, but that was certainly her reputation. I think it was more that in her early days on the stage, she was rebuffed. You can imagine the world of the prima donna. Regina Stoltz, who was the great singer at the Paris Opera, was the mistress of Léon Pied, who was the director of the opera. And so she got all the parts. And so Pauline was, in effect, sort of forced to tour because she was sort of marginalised by rivals. So perhaps because she hadn't got the recognition when she started out, she became a little bit more grasping about money and success later. And I think also probably as a Spaniard in this, or someone of Spanish descent in this French-dominated world, she had to have sort of sharp elbows. So she was quite a steely, entrepreneurial, hard-headed woman. Remarkable woman, I think, in many ways. Not without charm. I mean, a great presence, clearly, for all these men to fall in love with her. But for a woman of that time, you know, if we think of the women in the world of music, the Clara Schumanns and so on, they're quite sort of modest, even mousy figures, if you like. Well, Pauline was nothing of that.
Where does Britain fit into, I suppose, both sides of this story in terms of firstly in their lives, but also the wider cultural changes going on?
Well, in 1870, Pauline, Louis and Turgenev fled Baden-Baden to come to London because of the Franco-Prussian War. And as French inhabitants of Alsace, clearly life was uncomfortable for them there. And they lived in Marylebone. And Pauline and Louis had been to London many times before. I don't think they really liked London very much. Pauline thought it was a bit Philistine, I think one could say. Louis looked down his nose at the art world in London, thought that the British should keep away from the visual arts. He wrote many books of museum guides and a book that was a sort of international bestseller called The World of Sculpture. And he wrote in the preface to that book that he had been unable to include any English works because there were none worthy of inclusion. So they were typical of the continental Europeans who thought that the English were practical, rather money-minded, slightly Philistine people. But at the same time, Britain was a refuge for many continental revolutionaries. In particular, there were no immigration laws in Britain, nothing to stop anyone coming and making revolutionary propaganda here. And so it was a welcoming place for that reason. And it was also very, very rich, obviously. London was the most wealthy city in the world, certainly in Europe. And that meant that it was a great importer of all the arts. So the London art market was important. And it had three opera houses and a vibrant concert life. So it was a place where the Viardots came very frequently on tours and to perform at Covent Garden, and which they saw as a sort of large pot of money. But they never felt very comfortable here. Turgenev quite enjoyed the hunting in Cambridgeshire and in Scotland, where he went, met Robert Browning up there on one occasion. But he was slightly shocked when he visited Tennyson in Sussex. He'd read all Tennyson's works in English, and he'd read most English literature at that time in English and could talk about it in fluent English. And Tennyson hadn't read any of the continental writers that Turgenev recommended to him and hadn't even read anything by Turgenev. So this sort of insularity of the British was something that neither Turgenev nor the Viardots liked very much and could never settle here for that reason. And I suppose that insularity is another aspect of the book, because in that chapter when I cover the period they spend here, I look in more depth at how the British saw themselves as part of Europe or not. The British were great travellers in Europe. I mean, the mass tourism enabled by the development of the railways was really a British phenomenon more than it was of any other nationality. And yet the British, I think, toured Europe with a sense of moral superiority, particularly to Catholic Europe. They might feel an affinity with North German Protestant Europe, and indeed, because of the royal family, may think very highly of it. And those architects like Pugin, etc., were developing the Gothic style in a way that suggested that they saw the Germans as sort of racially related. But I think the rest of Britain, though, there was a sort of attitude towards Europe that Britain was different, particular, and superior. I think Henry Mayhew wrote in his notes on Germany in the 1860s that the further one went south in Europe, it was like traveling back in time. So that by the time one got to Spain, it was like entering the Middle Ages. And that was a fairly common Victorian attitude, which, as I've tried to argue, is deceptive, because actually the British were more European than they like to admit to themselves. So we're talking here about myths and stereotypes more than the reality, I think.
And you alluded earlier to the Franco-Prussian War and what effect that had. In general, how much did the big political events and military events of the period shape the culture? So you obviously had the 1848 revolutions and things like that. Were they having a big impact?
Oh, yes, very much so. And I think those two events you just mentioned are the sort of pivotal moments of the story I'm telling. 1848, because it's probably the first point at which the height of internationalism in the democratic nationalist movements across Europe. So we think of, you know, young Europe, we think of the Mazzinian movement for national liberation failed across Europe. And so nationalism in Germany and Italy had to take a different course. So it was Cavour and Bismarck that was to make those two countries respectively, not democratic movements. And the 1870-71 war, because that, I think, is the moment when political nationalism really gains force and Germany enters as a sort of dominant power in Europe in a way that not only reconfigures political alliances internationally, but also reconfigures the world culturally. So in a way to strengthen cultural nationalism in more, shall we say, ethnically exclusive ways. So in France, you know, the French took a very long time to get over the defeat of 1871. And so French hostility to Wagner, for example, remained very strong until, well, the 1910s and 20s, really. And it was, you know, very slowly that they incorporated Wagner into the French operatic repertoire. So those two events are pivotal in this story that I've been telling about these two trajectories, if you like. The cultural cosmopolitanism overlapping with, often in conflict with, but not necessarily mutually exclusive from the political nationalism, which is gaining force.
And I realise this is probably largely beyond the scope of your book, but how much does the rest of the world intrude into this story, specifically, I guess, the United States and also the European colonies?
Yes. Well, they do and they don't. I mean, it's a book about Europe and it's a book about the cultural integration of Europe and the broadening of Europe, as I think we've discussed, in the sense that countries like Spain and Russia are very much brought into the mainstream of European culture by the end of the 19th century. It's a book about the periphery of Europe, in which I include the Maghreb, littoral, the Ottoman world, and in a different sense, America. In that the high culture of these places is, to a certain extent, Europeanized. So, you know, Verdi's Aida is premiered in Cairo. In Constantinople, Istanbul, they're building a European-styled opera house. So it's a sign, if you like, of the power of European culture and of its unifying force, that Europe is taken as a model, if you like, by modernizing, westernizing non-European states that want to be like Europe. And so that's part of the story. but it's not central to it. I mean, that would be a different book. I mean, I think it might be a very interesting book, but it's only a sort of subtext, if you like, of the story I have to tell. That would be, you know, Europe for export. You know, I don't exclude America, or, you know, Latin America plays a part in the story, especially since that Viados went there in their early days. And nor do I exclude the colonies as, you know, as something not to be discussed. But it would be a different book if I was to write about how European culture was transformed in those arena.
At the moment, here in Britain, we're wrestling with our, you know, our place in Europe, and that's happening, I suppose, in other countries too. Do you feel that the story you're telling here can give us any pointers for what's going on now?
Well, I started this book a long time ago at a time when the idea that Britain could leave the European Union was unthinkable. And the referendum of 2016 took place when I was writing that chapter on the Viados in London. So I had to tone down some of my passion in the second and third and I think fourth and fifth drafts of that particular chapter. And I do think it has relevance and perhaps even lessons for where Britain and where Europe is today. Because I do believe that, you know, European culture has been a unifying force. You know, the EU since 1970-odd has been heavily promoting the idea of European culture as what makes Europe special. I think that most people, if they were asked to define what they meant by Europe, would include Beethoven, Goethe, Dickens, Monet, Stravinsky in that mix. I mean, the idea of Europe and the idea of European high culture is virtually synonymous. And it's always been what the EU has sort of championed as the European idea. The fact that Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is the European anthem is a symbol of that association between culture and the idea of Europe. And I think that in Britain, in particular, the years that Britain has been a member of the European Union has been a tremendous cultural blossoming in Britain. I mean, if you think back to the 1970s, Britain was culturally fairly homogenous. Food wasn't particularly good, certainly not very cosmopolitan. And since Britain has been a member of the European Union, we've had a tremendous opening up of British culture to international influences, global influences. Cool Britannia is cosmopolitan. It's a world in which, yes, you can get on the Eurostar and be in Paris for lunch. You can fly easily across Europe. And that sense of connectedness is, I think, a part of what makes it exciting to be alive today. And I think that's what people are worried about, partly, that if Britain withdraws from Europe and starts putting up borders, sure, you can still go to Paris, sure, you can still do that, but it might become more difficult. And the sort of movement of people, the fact that we have, you know, I don't know, it feels like a million Italians living in London at the moment. You know, we won't have so many. So that cosmopolitanism is part of the richness of our lives. And I think it is something that came into existence in the 19th century. It is really very much what my book has been about. And the book has also been an argument for that as something positive, that open borders are good for culture, that once you start trying to define your identity, your national identity in exclusive terms, Britain is something different from France and Europe, we want, you know, our warm beer and cricket and all the rest of it. That sort of inward-looking culture has never been a very vibrant force. The great periods of development in civilization have been periods of high internationalism. The Renaissance and the 19th century I've been writing about are key examples of that. So for culture to thrive, we have to remain open, and we have to cherish the European traditions of the 19th century and how much of our 20th century culture has built on that. And so, as I've written in the book, we must recognize the unifying force of European civilization, and countries who turn their back on that will do so at their peril.
That was Orlando Figes. The Europeans, Three Lives and the Making of a Cosmopolitan Culture is out now in the UK, published by Alan Lane. In the US, it's due out next month, published by Metropolitan. Excerpts of the book were read by Hugh Bonneville recently on BBC Radio 4's Book of the Week. Look out for that on the BBC Sounds app if you're in the UK. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Thursday when Janet Hartley will be discussing Catherine the Great.